ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, respect is what you always get from us, and respect is what I've absolutely got for our guest today. This guy is an incredible retired Marine officer. He's an incredible poet. He's a veterans advocate. He's been working on research activities, reviewing research, everything under the sun. Well, hey, David, welcome to Warrior Connection. I'm glad to finally have you.
Thanks for having me, Doug. Appreciate it.
You know, I mean, when I read your poetry and everything, the poetry that you've done, you've been able to capture the heart of the warrior. You've been able to explain things in simple terms that everybody can understand. I mean, as a warrior, how did you start writing poetry?
I don't actually recall when I've been writing for several years. I'm actually working on a book, a biographical type book that involves the Gulf War and the illness and all that. But somewhere around, I think it was probably after I retired from my civil service job 2 years ago, that, you know, when you have more time on your hands, your mind tends to wander. And I found my mind wandering towards poetry because, to me, it's a form of therapy, self-therapy. And that's why, you know, whenever I have interaction with other veterans who have been to combat and so forth, I encourage people to, you know, everybody thinks they, you know, people might think, well, I can't write any poetry, but you know what? Sometimes you sit and just think and write what comes out of your mind, even if it, at the time it may not make sense. And sometimes words or phrases, or you'll hear something on the radio or a song or just something, one word, two words, or a whole sentence, and it'll get your mind wandering about life and about how war affects the members of our military. It certainly changed me. I would say in some aspects it changed me for the better, more introspective. But in some aspects, war never leaves. You know, I don't consider myself a veteran that has PTSD, but I'll never forget some of the sights and sounds that I saw during the Gulf War in 1991. So, you know, I ended up writing some poems, and one led to another and another and another. And I'm probably up to 100 now that I could probably put together a book of poetry just by itself.
Yeah, it's so good because as I read your poetry and you keep sharing them with me and sharing them with everybody, mm-hmm. I mean, this is coming from the heart. It's not just, it's coming from deep down in the soul. I mean, you're picking up the feelings, the thoughts, the ideas, the concepts, and somehow you're getting them out there for us to see and understand because sometimes if you just think about them or you think about them passing, it doesn't have the same impact when you have to read it and think about it, what you've read, does it?
Well, it, like I say, to me, it, you know, I became very introspective after you know, being in the war and retired from the Marine Corps. I spent 20 years as a Marine, and I almost did 20 years without seeing a war. That used to be, that almost would have been a record, huh? But I was about 16 years into my career, and the Gulf War came along, and you know, we luckily, most of us made it out of there alive, but as we are now sadly finding out, we were exposed to some sort of environmental toxin or medicine or who knows what that made a lot of us sick. And that's what led me down the path as well to not only writing poetry and so forth and writing the book, but also going to bat for veterans. And, I got to give a lot of credit to Major Denise Nichols, who is a huge Gulf War veteran advocate. She's the one that inspired me to get involved on the advocacy side, and that kind of led me to being invited about 6 years ago to the CDMRP, the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program for Gulf War Illness. And in that capacity, what these panels have is they'll have mostly seven or eight doctors and PhDs that specialize in various illnesses and so forth, and they'll always have a couple of veterans as members of the panel with equal voting rights. And what we do in these panels is we look at the research grant proposals that come in from universities and research institutions all across the country and sometimes from overseas, and we evaluate their merit on the basis of whether or not, if successful, will this study lead to an effective treatment for Gulf War illness? Will it lead to better understanding of the etiology of the illness that in turn will lead to treatments? I'm not so sure we'll ever see a cure based on what we know now about what it's done to our bodies, But I think there's a very high probability that this research is leading in the direction of some very effective treatments that'll get our veterans off of, you know, a lot of us are on opiates now and the very addictive drugs that have horrible side effects and so forth. So, you know, I take pride in the fact that I got involved not only helping the individual veterans with VA claims, but getting involved on the research side of it to hopefully expedite, you know, some answers to Gulf War illness. Because here we are 24 years after the war, and we still haven't pinned down the exact cause of the illness, although the VA and the government has finally conceded that this is a physical illness. It's not a psychosomatic, it's all in your head illness, which they tried to say for many years. It's now been scientifically proven to be a physical illness, more than likely tied to the central nervous system.
Yeah, all this stuff, I mean, one of the things, and again, we've talked about this, you and I have discussed it, and Denise Nichols has discussed it, all of us have. There's always been this tendency for people to try and find one thing or one thing that caused it all. And what we knew from day one, it was the entire thing. I mean, we started out with the immunizations and everything went bad. Mm-hmm. And then we had all these endemic diseases that everybody brought because here we're mobilizing military units from not only all over the United States, active duty, reserve, guard, and everything else, but then we're mobilizing all these units from all over the world that came together.
Correct.
So we brought all these endemic diseases together. We had all these immunizations. Then we had the incredible problem with all the hazardous materials releases just from a military force and operations, much less everything we blew up and got released.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had all the pesticides, and we had all everything else, and we had depleted uranium, and we had all the nerve agents. I mean,
right.
Jimmy, I mean, I know you know Jimmy Tute also very well, like I do, and we knew before, and then Jimmy Tute came out with a report for the Regal Commission for the United States Senate, which confirmed that the U.S. sent all this stuff over there.
Yeah.
So we decided to blow it up, and man, it just is a toxic wasteland.
Well, don't forget, and by the way, I encourage all of the listeners, if they haven't already, to Google the Regal Report, which I believe was issued in 1994 by then-Senator Donald Regal, and his investigator was Jim Tute. And what they revealed in that study, in that investigation, was that our own Department of Commerce had approved the transfer of the formulas for a whole list of biological warfare agents and even the formulas for how to make sarin and mustard gas and so forth. They gave that stuff to Saddam Hussein in about 1988 to use in his war against the Iranians. So we were kind of helping arm them. And isn't it odd that time after time when we go to war and we provide these, quote, allies with hardware, it ends up being used back at us. And it's happening all over again here in Iraq and Afghanistan with we've got Al-Qaeda driving around in Humvees and MRAP vehicles now. And it's just incredible how stupid we are sometimes when we go to war and when we come home.
Yeah, I think
anyway, on the Regal report, don't forget that it wasn't just the medicines and the whole list of potential toxins in the burning wells. It was also the potential that this was a biological that this illness may very well lie in a biological or viral form, and that's something that's being talked about at high levels of government right now within the CDMRP. I can tell you, although I can't be specific. But they have not ruled out that this could possibly, there's no doubt that their neurological system is damaged, but the question is what damaged it. And it's not beyond the realm of impossibility that it could be caused by a virus or some sort of a biological warfare agent. And, you know, another source that I would encourage folks to look at is a book called Long Strange Journey, written by, it's an intelligence memoir by a guy by the name of, I'm trying to remember his name, but he worked for the CIA as an analyst, and he claims to this day, Patrick Eddington is his name.
Yeah, Pat, I know Pat.
Yeah, he claims that that the government, the CIA, is still holding thousands of classified documents that pertained precisely to certain environmental exposures. So I think, you know, there's certain folks in government who know what caused Gulf War illness, but they are not at liberty to disclose that. So it's funny. You've got the Department of Defense funding the Congress funding the Department of Defense under the CDMRP to find the answers to Gulf War illness. You've got another branch of the government that could probably answer a lot of those questions. So the left hand often doesn't know what the right hand is doing. It's almost like it's tragic, but it's comical at the same time. That if they could declassify some of these documents, it would really help the scientists find some cures.
Well, we knew that from day one. I mean, one of the things that did this and all happen, I mean, at Third MedCom, we had all the stuff, we had all the intel, and that was the decision we made in December 10th of 1990 to destroy all of Rack's chemical and biological stockpiles in place. And that, I mean, that's in Schwarzkopf's autobiography, It Doesn't Take a Hero, on page 390. Mm-hmm. But then all the decisions were made, again, all the way up to the Surgeon General's office to disregard all this. And so it just turned into a friggin' total nightmare. I mean, there isn't a single day goes by. I know you were involved and we were involved here. We had another veteran that was still getting refused care with all the known medical problems, and his doctor was refusing to refer him to the Warringer's Clinic here a couple weeks ago. All of us worked on that, and we got that solved. That VA doctor found out that you can't refuse to comply with written directives.
Yeah.
It's kind of frightening. There's so much happening today. I mean, when we look all over the place, we've got the ongoing wars. We've got ongoing releases of toxic materials. We've got all of these installations throughout the United States. We've got Chanute Air Force Base right here in Rantoul.
Mm-hmm.
And I know down in Texas, the military installations are a toxic nightmare. I've been there, done that, got that T-shirt.
Remember Camp Lejeune? Well, that's another list I'm on. Anybody who spent time at Camp Lejeune, I think from the 1950s through 82 or 88, was exposed to, they found out, contaminated well water.
Trichloride.
And there's a whole list of cancers that are now considered presumptive to those exposures, and that affects not just veterans who served there, but all the family members who lived on base. There's a great documentary called Semper Fi, Always Faithful, that you can find on Netflix that tells the whole story of the Camp Lejeune mess. And again, once again, the government creates a problem, and then they do their damnedest to cover it up after the fact because they're afraid of liability. But you know what? That's the cost of having the military, and that's the cost of warfare. If you're going to go to war, if you're going to prepare for war, you better prepare for the after effects, because they're often more costly than the war itself.
Now, your own career, you were both enlisted and officer, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, another one of those old things. I mean, at one time they called us Mustangers, but I'm not sure if they use that
term
anymore.
I'll give you an example. As a young enlisted corporal and sergeant, I remember at camp at Marine Corps Air Station, Yuma, Arizona, we used to clean our generator parts. I was a generator repair technician, electrical equipment repairman as an enlisted Marine. And I used to sit and clean the parts off my diesel generators, some of the electronic parts, with trichloroethylene, pure, right out of it. We had 1 gallon cans of it, and we just poured in a pan with a paintbrush, and with our bare hands sit there and clean these parts. And it's a great degreaser and cleaner, but the problem is it gets, you know, it soaks into your body, it dries out your skin, and it probably goes into the tissue and does who knows what. But the worst part was we were ordered, after we used this stuff, just dump it on the ground, you know, because they claimed that it would evaporate and not go into the water table. Well, years later, they're finding out that's not the case. It's such a, you know, the molecules in that chemical are so small that it goes right down in, you know, makes its way right down into the water table in no time flat. And it's a carcinogen. It's a known carcinogen. And it's one of the chemicals that they're finding a lot of under Camp Lejeune and a lot of the other military bases. They were used in aircraft maintenance and all sorts of maintenance activities for years, trichloroethylene, commonly known as TCE.
Yeah, it's a real nightmare. I mean, you had a totally different perspective. I mean, being a Marine Corps sergeant, first off, Semper Fi, going through a whole lot of that stuff, but then becoming an officer, that gave you an entirely different perspective on how the Marine Corps operated and what was needed to be done and everything, didn't it?
It did, and that's, you know, it's interesting you mention that because, you know, the book I've put together that hopefully one day I'll publish, it talks about the lessons learned. It doesn't just talk about the Gulf War. It talks about the lessons I learned as a young enlisted Marine, as a the transition from going from enlisted to officer, some of the surprises I was met with as a young officer, and finding out that, in a nutshell, that, you know, officers, they're often portrayed as these flawless human beings, when in fact they're just as messed up as some of the enlisted guys. And some of the stuff I witnessed from my fellow officers, I could tell you stories to the end of time. But so I just tried my best to follow my instincts and my training and to do the right thing. And it's amazing how much we learn in life from watching others fail. And that's a lot of what's in my book, is about lessons learned about doing what's morally right, standing up for what's morally right. And that's part of the ongoing battle today with Gulf War illness, is that, yes, I'm an officer, a retired Marine, and I put Captain USMC at my salutation at the end of everything I write. And I figure that, you know what, once a Marine, always a Marine. I'm still sworn to that oath that says I have an obligation, a moral obligation, to take care of my Marines. And I will do that until the day I take my last breath on this earth, is because if I've got Marines that are still down on the battlefield, and that's the way I consider them, we still have Marines down in combat, it's, even though it's 24 years ago, they're back home now and they're suffering, and I cannot in good conscience turn a blind eye to that kind of stuff. And furthermore, by standing up to this immorality that we see in our government, I think, you know, when you fight against this type of stuff, you know, and whatever successes you have along the way will hopefully make changes for the better for our current modern day and our future warriors. You've got to do what's right. Don't go along with the herd mentality. And, you know, it's interesting. You watch the news these days of all these guys, the secretaries and the generals retired, and then they come out and write books and put down the administration and say how bad they are. Well, my question to those officers and those secretaries and cabinet members is if they're so morally just, why didn't they do the right thing when they were on active duty? Why wait until you are retired to speak out? And that's what I did during my career. I'm not bragging about it, but there's a reason I didn't make major or lieutenant colonel, is because sometimes it's necessary to rattle the cage a little bit and get people's attention and stand by your morals. And I never once, during the time I was in, when I stood up for the morally correct thing, I never once paid a price for it. I upset a lot of people in the chain of command, but when you're right, they can't do anything to you. You may not make a lot of friends along the way, but as a leader, your job is not to make friends. Your job is to lead.
You got to make those hard decisions. I think all the way through, I mean, I learned the same thing as you do, having been a senior enlisted. I mean, I was sitting there as an E6 getting ready, so on as E7 when I got my second lieutenant's bar. And so it was a whole strange world. But when you see something wrong, you got to remember that, you, as you said, you got to take care of the troops. I mean, a story I've told before, especially we talk in the Air Force, because I was in the Air Force in Vietnam era, and between missions, our commanding general had put us to sleep up in his control tower. We were sound asleep, and this colonel came up there jumping and screaming and yelling, "Why, no, we were all sleeping on duty." And the general stood up and walked over, pushed me down. I said, "When I ask them to sleep, they sleep. When I ask them to work, they work. And right now it's time to sleep." Then he looked at all of us and said, "Just remember, no matter where you are or what you're doing, to take care of the troops first. That's your obligation."
Mm-hmm.
When we went to Desert Storm, that same commanding general who I've known my entire life came to me and ended up sending us care packages to my unit in Desert Storm. But as I got ready to leave here, he said, "Hey, Doug, I took care of you in Nam. Now, are you going to take care of him now?" And I, "You betcha, sir."
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are rare officers, though. When you see the senior officers, I mean, we've had a handful, and you've met those handful.
Yeah.
But most of them kind of like they got their rank, they got their jobs, they got out, they got their nice, cushy job as a consultant, and they walked away without fulfilling obligations or responsibilities. For me, that's frustrating.
It is. It's one of the things I constantly echo, and I said this to the I testified before the Institute of Medicine 2 years ago on the issue of Gulf War illness, and it was a public hearing, and I went on the microphone and I just said it like it was. I said, I'm just a lowly captain of Marines. You know, I said, where are my colonels? Where are my generals? Where were our leaders? Where are our leaders from Desert Storm, who, even if they're not sick themselves, and even if they have maybe some doubts about the illness, you know, morally, they ought to be speaking out to the media and helping us out, you know, but there's so many of them. You know, it's amazing. If you go down the list of all the high-ranking generals and everything that led divisions and brigades and so forth during the war, these guys retired and went to work for companies like Bechtel and Raytheon and, you know, the old military-industrial complex, you know, and sadly, even to this day, and you see it on the news constantly, is that there's this conspiracy of silence. If you want to get promoted, if you want to rise up through the ranks, you got to sometimes play the game, and playing the game doesn't always sync with doing what's morally correct. And that's what that's the problem I had with the hierarchy in the military, is that they were so too inclined to not face up to moral injustice and so forth, because they were afraid of, damage in their career prospects. And to me, that's not leadership. That's selfish. That's just self-centered, behavior. And I just, it irks me to this day. And so when I see, the secretary or the general coming out writing a book about how screwed up the current administration is, I'm thinking, okay, great. How come you didn't say something when you were there? Why didn't you resign in protest in front of CNN and Fox News, and protest this stuff in public when you had a little bit of a bully pulpit? Now you wait till after the fact, where now they can't reach out and demote you or whatever, or not promote you. Now you're brave and you're going to tell all these truths about how screwed up things are. And so that's where I have a problem, is because we have a military that's run by politicians, basically, from the top down, and from the bottom up. To make general, if you're not politically correct, at least this is the case in the Marine Corps to this day, if you don't say and do the right things, even if they're morally incorrect, you're not going to get promoted.
Yeah, I think what's frightening to me, and again, come back to the senior leadership, and we've had the last two secretaries, U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, we had were both Army generals. I mean, General Peake, yep, and General Shinseki.
Correct.
And as you and I both know, and I mean both of us were involved, both of them have been totally and thoroughly briefed. They knew about all the exposures. They knew about the health and environmental effects. Mm-hmm. Both of them had signed, absolutely personally signed orders mandating medical care for all these exposures. And yet, look what happened to the VA, and it continues to happen. I mean, I think we're seeing changes and improvement, but it's still a nightmare, and it was led by leaders who knew what should have been done and should be done and still needs to be done.
Well, sadly, I think what goes on in the hierarchy of the government, especially when you're dealing with the Department of Defense or Veteran Affairs or anything else, you're still subject to, there's issues about classified information. There's things that they know that they cannot discuss. There's things that they know that they can't act upon. And so that's why I'm convinced that a lot of our senior leaders from the Gulf War are aware of what happened, but are not at liberty to speak out. Even after you retire, there's a lot of classified stuff, you can't disclose at the risk of, you're going to go to prison. So there's this, I don't know, it's very frustrating. It's hard to describe sometimes, but to me it just comes down to failure of leadership. And as a consequence of that, here we are 24 years after the war trying to figure out exactly which of these known toxins, underscore the word known, made us sick. Maybe one or maybe all of the above. But I tell you, one of the things that we're talking about on the CDMRP, I'm not allowed to speak directly about specific research proposals, but there's some interest now in epidemiology studies, and that is that, surprisingly enough, the Department of Veterans Affairs, DOD, nobody seems to know, nobody seems to keep track of the veterans of the Gulf War who have certain illnesses and how many and what category and what, whether a male, female. Nobody's keeping track of the cause of death when a Gulf War veteran dies in his 50s. I mean, we're reading about these things in the paper, and we hear it on social media that so-and-so died of brain cancer. But that begs the question, how many others, from the Gulf War have died of brain cancer? What are the statistics? And so I hope to see some studies in the future that where they get some folks in there that have access to information and put this data together, because I predict that if you can show that there's a trend in brain cancer or a trend in whatever illness or symptom, it's gonna expedite the and focus the research. It can't help but do that. I'm just shocked that 24 years later, we don't know. We're always reading, one thing when you read an obituary, very seldom does an obituary mention the cause of death. But somebody needs to dig into these deaths, especially the ones, the folks that are dying at premature ages, and figure out, the data and how many died of this illness and how many died of that, because I think that's going to shed some light on where we ought to focus our studies.
Yeah, so, hopefully it will do something. I mean, all of this stuff that's been going on for so long is totally flustering. I mean, the individual becomes real sick, and then we have the family members that are sick because of cross-contamination.
Yeah.
I mean, we've discussed that before, totally confirmed down there right by you at Fort Hood in Texas, and all these other installations. And now we got an entire new generation from Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, where the Institute of Medicine is right at 2 years ago now, totally confirmed that all this stuff was multiple chemical toxic exposures, multiple chemical sensitivity. So the IOM is coming up in 2 years right now where they finally confirmed that and said, well, we need to do something. But then it seems, and this is for me flustering, I know it's flustering for you, is they say we need to do something, but then nothing translates into action. And I don't understand that to this day. I'm flustered.
Well, on the good news is we are making progress on the research side, and evidence of that was published a couple of days ago in the Military Times, and the headline reads, and this is one of the I believe it was one of the CDMR funded studies, study links genetics and anti-nerve agent pills to Gulf War illness. So this particular study, Dr. Leah Steele did. It was a small cohort of subjects that they studied, but there's strong evidence that shows that we've long suspected explains why, they say 1 in 4 or 1 in 3 Gulf War veterans got sick. And why is that? Why did not everybody get sick? And the answer, I think, lies in genetics, that there's genetic predisposition that everybody is born with that makes some people almost superhuman and resistant to chemical exposures, certain chemical exposures and biological exposures, whereas others are very susceptible to chronic illness when exposed to even the most minute doses of this stuff. So they are finding out a lot on the genetic side, and hopefully that'll bear some fruit later on. But they still, this particular study that was in the Military Times, they used anti-nerve agent pills as the model to, I think they used mice, and actually it was a combination of animal models and human testing, non-invasive human testing, to find out that, there is a genetic component here. So we are making progress, but, it just seems to be so slow that it is frustrating.
You talk about the anti-nerve gas. Well, I mean, first off, nerve agents are liquids. They're not gases. They're mist.
I'm talking about the PB pills.
Yeah, you're talking about pyridostigmine bromide. Pyridostigmine bromide is a carbamate-based pesticide itself. And the reason that was administered, and again, we had to administer it during Desert Storm because we absolutely knew Iraq had it because the U.S. Army gave it to them. So strange. I mean, this was the real intel that we had. Mm-hmm. And so what does the pyridostigmine bromide does? The pyridostigmine bromide is reversible if you administer atropine, diazepam, and pyridoxamine chloride, in contrast to the non-reversible bonds for sarin, soman, VX, and all the multiple sevens and Novichoks. So the idea was, and this came out, and this was in day one stuff in Desert Storm, well, we'll make everybody take the PB. Now, if they do use the nerve agents, what they do absolutely have, and they are weaponized and they are deployed, then the people can take the antidote and they can recover.
Right.
Well, we had exposures, but they were low-level exposures, and then mixed with all the misuse of pesticides, and then we all had all the stuff where they were spraying all the uniforms with a pesticide.
Right.
So that got absorbed. So now we're seeing incredible neurological problems from very small incremental doses that when they came back, then they got zapped by a household pesticide or an agricultural pesticide, and next thing we know, we're crashing and burning. But then again, as Leah Steele had found, that's your genetic code susceptibility.
Yeah. It's frustrating, and again, I think it comes down to on the side where the government's not declassifying documents. I think that would answer a lot of questions, but the obvious reason they're not is because there's this thing in government about legacies and political legacies, military legacies, and Desert Storm, as you recall, we came home the victorious, everybody was a hero for such a magnificent performance in a short war and very decisive war. And then to have to admit, if the government had to admit later on that they made these mistakes, it kind of takes away some of the glamour, you know what I mean? And not only that, is it's embarrassing publicly to these individuals and destroys their legacies, but it also opens their door to liability, not only for our veterans, but what about the indigenous populations, the people who have to live in these areas, you know, in the centuries that follow these battles? And that's especially true, as you very well know, with depleted uranium.
Yeah, I mean, that's one definitely happened. We found that out from day one. I think the frustrating part about that is, oh, boy. You sit there and think about it, and each time I think about it and come back or somebody comes out, and I remember what happened and what needed to be done and what wasn't done. We knew we had the toxic exposures. We knew the health effects were there. We directed the medical care. And then what happened is they made the conscious decision to withhold the medical care. I mean, that's what happened on depleted uranium. That's what happened on the nerve agent exposures. I mean, we had the, and again, this was a major study. I mean, you might have been involved in this, in Bob Haley's study when he did the work on the Seabees with the nerve agent exposures. I mean, the Seabees out of Alabama, no doubt about it, they were hit by a scud, hit by nerve agents, and had all of the serious health problems.
Right.
And Haley verified that, and then once the research was published, well, they went after Bob Haley with all guns blazing to try and discredit him.
It took away his funding, too.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
That's what happens. You start uncovering the truth, and funny things start to happen. You know, not funny, but some serious things. And I tell you, I, you know, we talk about morality, and we talk about doing the right thing, and sometimes you got to do it in spite of the risks. There are indeed risks involved in confronting the government. I've been audited 3 different times by the IRS, and I very suspect it all started. Here was the timeline. I was asked by a very large military officers organization about 3-4 years ago to give a speech on Gulf War illness and the possible causes. And I did. I complied and went down there one night and gave about a one-hour presentation. And I talked about depleted uranium, tainted vaccines, all of these known exposures that might be at the root of Gulf War illness. And there were some retired generals in the audience that night. And when I concluded my presentation and went for questions, you could have heard a pin drop. I mean, there were several of these guys that were visibly upset that I was just even talking about this stuff. Now, they invited me, you know. Well, anyway, fast forward 2 weeks later to the day, in that same city where I gave that speech, the office of the IRS knocked on my door and said, we're going to audit you. So they audited my taxes for 1 year, and they got done with that, and I said, okay, and then a couple weeks later, I got another audit notice for the following year, and they did 3 consecutive audits, 3 years in a row. And I, to this day, I know that somebody blew the whistle and said, you got a retired Marine down there talking in public about these very sensitive subjects. Now, I didn't talk about anything that was classified. This is all known information, but just talking about it. And I had also, around that same period of time, written an op-ed, a half-page op-ed in the Daily Breeze newspaper in Torrance, California. You can still find it online, about the dangers of health risk of modern warfare. And I outlined all of this stuff. And the more I became public about this stuff and talking about it, I think I got the attention of some people in Washington, and they put the screws to me, I'm telling you. But you know what? I'm still talking, and until you find me someplace in a landfill or something, I'm going to keep talking because I have a moral obligation to do that. But I would not put it past certain people in our government to target folks with things like audits or doing something to take their attention off and kind of send a signal out that you better shut your mouth, you know?
Yeah, I sent here about 24 hours ago, I sent out the Vision 11 VA Physicians Directives on Gulf War illness and what the medical signs and symptoms are and medical care needed to be done. And boy, it was an email went back out from a U.S. Air Force colonel within 12 hours.
I know who you're talking about.
You know, trying to shoot Doug Rocky in the foot and, you know, discredit him and everything else. But, I mean, this wasn't my document. This was a VA document that was coming from a Congressman Davis's office.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they can't be a happy camper because here's these hidden documents they don't want to be seen that congressional staff now have, and they're helping the vets get them out. And hopefully we'll get more and more congressional, you know, legislators, congressmen, and both representatives and senators, God bless Bernie Sanders, they're going to help people.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, that same, I think it's that same Air Force colonel you're talking about. I won't mention his name, but he's known to have close ties with the Department of Defense. And I think he's a shill, and I think he's paid to basically attack folks that start talking about the truth. And so they have people that are, you know, operatives that do that kind of thing and try to publicly shame you or whatever. But you gotta stand your ground. You gotta do what's right, and you gotta, you know, I'm not afraid. Because during my career, during my active duty years, there's some things I said and did that I'd wake up the next day and say, you know, my career is over. But, you know, looking back, it never, you know, they can try. They can try to screw you up and they can try to mess with you, but they can't do it in a legitimate way, because then, you know, you could, you know, the tables could be turned on them real quickly. So, but I think there is a cohort out there that's in the business of trying to shut this information down, even though, again, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. Granted, the DOD sponsors the CDMR program, the research program, but there are certain aspects of that same department that probably know for sure what caused the illness. So they're playing, you know, it's like playing a game of poker, you know.
Smoke and mirrors. I think what was important, I've seen some of the research studies, and I've had researchers contact me after the fact, not involved in a review or anything. But what they found out is they were awarded the research study, but then the Department of Defense didn't provide them with all the essential information that was in the actual unclassified, you know, data books and all this stuff. And then the researchers trying to do the research without the pertinent information.
Right.
And then when we gave it to the researcher, they were totally flustered because, oh, my God, you knew it from this day one. And we had certain representatives, Mikey Kilpatrick, told them otherwise.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, Bernie and Mikey, well, we'll tell you something, even though it's not factual, we'll tell you something else to pull off the truth. And that, for me, it's wrong.
Well, that's the way the cookie crumbles, so to speak. That's the way they operate. But, you know, it's like I talked about earlier. It's to me, it's mind-boggling that 24 years after the war, with all these serious illnesses and countless deaths, premature deaths of our veterans, that no one in the government has bothered to sit down, or if they have, they're not making it public, and do statistic analysis of the deaths and the cause and the illnesses and so forth. And I think that alone would be a huge asset to anybody conducting a medical research program, to have that information. It's going to point them in the right direction. But barring that, all you're doing is delaying and making it more difficult for the research to make meaningful strides.
Now, one of the things you've been involved in and I've been involved in, there's an incredible array of documentaries that are out there. I mean, Gary Knoll and Progressive Radio Network, I mean, this is what we're on right now. He did Killing Our Own and set everything up. Chris Martini at that time was working for Gary when they did Killing Our Own.
Right.
And then Chris Martini has gone on to do a landmark full feature film.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Doug. The film is called Trooper. Just one word in capital letters, Trooper. And it's a film by Chris Martini. He wrote it, he directed it, and he even stars in it. And his brother is a very famous movie star who was is in movies, Captain Phillips, a whole host of other. He was the guy who played the SEAL commando commander in Captain Phillips. His name is Max Martini. But Chris Martini put together this film, and it's one of the best coming home from war films I've ever seen. And what I like about it is the fact that they talk about this veteran's exposure to depleted uranium, and it also touches on the post-traumatic stress issue. He did a great job of acting. And there's a couple of very well-known actors in that movie that people recognize from All the President's Men and a couple other big movies. But this is a great film that's now on, it's available on iTunes for rental or sale. And you can watch it on Vimeo if you can stream it on video. Vimeo, that's V-I-M-E-O. And it'll soon be out on DVD. I highly encourage all veterans or anybody who cares about veterans to watch that film. It's called Trooper, a film by Christopher Martini. And I'll tell you, it's a very moving story, but it tells the truth. And it deals with this issue of what warriors come home with. And on that note, I wonder if maybe it's time for a couple of poems that might...
I think let's finish up on Chris Martini's film. It's dealing not only with the current time, but his father in the film was a Vietnam era veteran that was dealing with all the Vietnam Agent Orange films that are tied together.
Why don't you read some of the lines in the movie, which just really hit the nail on the head, last couple of days
that ties this all together. I mean, it hit me to the soul.
Yeah. The father says to the son, "Well, it looks like we're going to bury, we're going to bury each other," or something like that. But it's really that link to bring those two generations of warriors together, father and son. And what was touching was the fact that war brought them closer together. At the same time, war destroyed both of them and probably literally killed both of them in time. But I tell you, it was a very moving film, and I predict he's going to go places in the motion picture industry because the guy really gets it when it comes to veteran and war-related issues. How about a poem?
Please do, David. Ladies and gentlemen, U.S. Marine Corps Captain David Wynette and Poetry for Our Military. God bless you, David. Please read some poems.
Sure. This one is called Ghost of War. And it touches on the fact that warfare, you go to war and you come home, but all too often war comes home with you. And so here it is. It's called Ghost of War. I'll be coming home soon from war, my dear. Can't wait till your beautiful eyes I see. Oh, and in case I forget to mention it, war will be coming home with me. But you needn't worry your precious heart. You'll hardly notice he's there. For war has a knack for discretion and stealth. He'll be hidden where you can't see. For all intents and purposes, you'll think it's the same old me. I wish it could be some other way, but it's not for me to say. Anyone who has been to war knows exactly what I mean. The sights and smells and horrors of war are forever a part of our dreams. No one escapes the lasting effects of war except those who die in the fight. Perhaps in the end, they're really the fortunate ones. Like their lives, their pain is here and gone at the blinding speed of light. So look for me soon as the big day draws near, and please, you have nothing at all to prepare. You need not set an extra place at the table. War has all it wants to consume as it lives in deep inside of me. There's nothing at all that you need to do for me, for it's me who will act as host. He'll be living in me for the rest of my days, my very own personal ghost. That's called the Ghost of War.
Wow, I mean, when we look at homecoming coming back from war, I mean, I had the experience multiple times from Vietnam and then Desert Storm and then the DU project and a whole bunch of other stuff where, I got called and I had to go and I had to come back home. And then when you get home, you find out that the responsibilities you had have changed. The interactions you're going to have with people absolutely have changed. Right. You yourself has changed. And, Ruth Crocker was on this show a couple of weeks ago, and her husband was killed in Vietnam in May of 1969. She talked about those who remain.
Yeah.
It's a horrible thing. We don't think about it. Dave, can you read some more of your poems, please?
Sure. This one is called Warrior for Peace because, speaking on a personal level, in a 20-year retired Marine, I went to the Marine Corps. I was trained to fight and kill, and I was trained for warfare, and that day finally came 16 years into my career. And I went into combat, and fortunately, I wasn't involved in any direct firefights, but like anybody who was on the battlefield, we witnessed some pretty horrible things that occurred even before we set foot in Kuwait. We came over the border after a 5-week bombing campaign that basically decimated the Iraqi troops, and what we saw as we drove up towards, to take Kuwait City, there are sights and sounds that you'll never forget. So war changes you no matter what your role in it, whether you're in a support role or as they call, the tip of the spear. And so I think it changes you, and this poem is called Warrior for Peace. Ask me again, ask me to fight again, then fight I shall. Ask me to hate, I've forgotten how. Rally round the flag, you say, let's go across the world, killing those who need killing today. Don't you love your country, boy? Don't you want to redeploy? Have you no honor? Where's your manliness and pride? Why are you not a patriot? Kill or be killed, no, sir, I say. Love and be loved is the answer to all of it. He who hates the most, we've all been told, shall rule the world, its people, its riches, and all its gold. A wise man once wrote in a famous song, imagine all the people living life in peace. The song was sung, embraced throughout the world. No one doubted him, not in the least. His message was clear. The answer was love. The goal was nothing less than worldwide peace. But sadly, his dream didn't come to pass. Instead, the man who told us all we need is love and peace was shot down dead, shot in the back on a New York street. Another wrote of putting presidents, prime ministers, and kings on shelves to fight it out amongst themselves, while all the people stood together and sang a simple song of freedom as all the world's walls and fences fell. Where, my God, does the answer truly lie? How many tears are too many to be cried? How many sons of yours and daughters of mine will we send off to their deaths in the name of war, the ultimate, the biggest lie? So you ask me if I'll fight again? I will. But the fight I'll fight is not to kill. I've had my share. I've been to war. And in the name of love, I'll have no more. But hear me now and hear me clear. I'll fight until my dying breath. I'll fight with every ounce of will to remind the world of what God once said to all mankind, thou shalt not kill, vengeance is mine. The answer lies not in death by war, but in a world where people have no reason to feel hate or fear, a world where lust for greed and power are allowed to exist no more. This, my friend, is the message I send. A warrior in war once long ago is now a warrior for peace until the day I go.
Amen.
So, warrior for peace. And I... Again, it came from my heart. I mean, I'm not, don't get me wrong. I mean, if this country is threatened, I'm the first one that's going to take up arms to defend it. But I think warfare has taken on, you know, just like Dwight Eisenhower said on January 17th of 1960, when he gave his farewell speech, he warned us of the undue influence of the military-industrial complex and how these businesses that make money from warfare gain undue political influence in Washington and basically become cheerleaders for war. And I think, unfortunately, to this day, that they have a huge say and a huge vote in whether or not we go to war. And I'll tell you, this whole thing, when you look at all the evidence and put all the pieces together and you evaluate whether or not a war is necessary, 9 times out of 10, it's not. There's ways to get around it. There's ways to fight for peace rather than go around killing people just to flex your muscle. So I'm a changed man from being a United States Marine, and I'm proud of my heritage as a Marine. And again, if war ever comes to our shores, I'll be the first one to take up arms. But I think we need to, you know, concentrate on defense rather than offense. My daughter, a couple of years ago, when she was in middle school, she came to me one day and she said, "Dad," she says, "Why do they have a Department of Defense? Why don't they, you know?" And I thought about it. I go, "You know what? It used to be called the Department of War. Maybe we should change it back, because really that's where we're at now. So we have a Department of War. We don't have a Department of Defense." Our emphasis is not on defense. Our emphasis now seems to be on offense. And so I really believe Dwight Eisenhower hit the nail on the head, and I also believe, this is off the subject, but I believe that John Kennedy paid the ultimate price because he didn't go along with these guys, the generals of that time, and I think he paid for it with his life, and I'll always believe that.
I met John Kennedy. I was probably 7th, 8th grade. Adlai Stevenson brought John Kennedy up to Chicago and to Libertyville, where I was growing up, and mm-hmm. I got to meet him one-on-one, and I never forget that to this day. I mean, I was standing there at arm's length away, and he had his arm on my shoulder, and, you know, all of us, it was an incredible man. I think, you know, with all the flag waving, and I mean, your poetry is touching the heart. When we go to war, we got all this flag waving. We got people putting bumper stickers out there waving flags or yelling and screaming how good the troops did.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to push gets to shove, well, will you give me a ride to the VA? Will you help me mow my lawn? Or will you help me build a ramp so that I can get up with my wheelchair? you don't see any of these people out there helping each other. I mean, it's sort of like, well, we'll send you to war, and then we abandon you when you come back.
Yeah, it's a trend. It's a style. It's stylish to say you support the troops, but how many people, you're right, how many people actually put their money where their mouth is and do something meaningful to support returning veterans? Very good point. I think it becomes a, you know, everybody's trending. Everybody wants to do what's popular, you know, and sometimes the people that speak out against that and say, hey, you know, we're not talking about popularity here. Let's do what's practical. Those people are attacked as if they're the villains, you know, and that's, it's pretty odd how that happens. But yeah, it's more than a bumper sticker or a magnet on your car or even a flag. It's doing something meaningful. And not on that note, that includes your obligation to vote for politicians who maybe will think twice before they send our country to war, before they send our sons and daughters off to defend foreign oil fields. Because that's really the only reason we've been in that area of the world for the last 30 or 40 years.
Well, going back to, all that was set up by the Sykes-Picot Treaty in 1916, 1917, between the French and the British, and then the U.S. got involved.
Yeah.
So it goes back historically from day one. I mean, we're running down. We got a few more minutes here left.
How about another poem about morality?
And the community organizations start posting all of these documentaries. How do we get them to post all of the documents? We've got the post-deployment physical assessment form that the military did and then they lost, and the veterans can't get it. We got the VA physician's guidance that Congressman Davis is sending out. We have all of the orders and regulations for medical care on depleted uranium and pesticides.
Right.
But I don't find these on the American Legion DAV or VFW or any of these websites, so the veteran has access to them. It's turned into, and I know you've been totally involved, the one-on-one thing where the person contacts them, we get them the document, then they take it to their doctor, the doctor says no, and then we yank their chain, and then the doctor says yes.
Well, I think I have a partial answer to that question, and that is social media. I created a Facebook page called Gulf War Illnesses, as in plural, Gulf War Illnesses. It's on Facebook, and it's a closed group that I started about 5 years ago. It's the largest Gulf War Illnesses page on Facebook. We have we're approaching 8,000 members now, most of them veterans or veteran family members. And on that page, we have a lot of our members have posted files that include a lot of the documents you're talking about. There's a lot of ongoing discussion about helping individual veterans with claim issues, giving them information on exposures so that they can better understand their illnesses. And not only that, convey the medical information and exposures to their medical providers so that at least we can, you know, you got to educate your doctor when you go to the doctor and how what better way to do that than to produce these documents that come from the government about, you know, how to deal with Gulf War illness, and more importantly, what it is, you know.
And well, I mean, your website was totally instrumental, and Andy, we know Andy, you and I both know, and work we did, Andy showed up on your website asking for help, and and we got him definitive help now, as you know.
But well, it goes everywhere. We've got people
that
had
to yank the chain and force his doctor to admit what was happening and comply with their own guidelines, but it happened in this case.
Yeah, it's amazing that the VA's own website is very explicit in listing what all the symptoms are and what all the presumptive illnesses are for Gulf War veterans, and yet these Gulf War veterans go to a compensation and pension exam, and the physician that's examining them has no idea what's on their own website. He works for the VA. It's amazing that they haven't been trained. In fact, I brought that up last week in Baltimore when I was at the CDMRP meeting. We had a rep there from the VA, and I said, you know, you need to teach all of your physicians at all the regions across the country how to deal with Gulf War illness. You need to educate them about what it is and what they can do to better understand their patients, because the majority, I would have to say, of physicians in VA facilities across this country, you mention Gulf War illness to them, and they just stare at you with a glassy eye. They don't have a clue what it is, and all they have to do is look at their own website. It's amazing how ignorant these people are.
Yeah, I mean, Jim Benz and the Research Advisory Committee, I mean, it was 2008 where they came out that with an incredible report. I mean, Leah Steele is definitely a major player in that.
Yep.
But that report is totally ignored by the VA physicians and nurses and the administration, and here was her own definitive report that's what now, 5 years ago? No, 6 years. Yeah. 7 years ago.
Yeah.
You got another poem here, David, that you can read one or two more before we, as we wound out the time?
Well, let's talk about morality. This one's called The Endowment. When you leave, what will you leave behind? When you're gone, what signs will say that you were here? Beyond the tears that will be shed by those who love you, what lasting legacy of value will validate your having spent a lifetime on this earth? My friend, it will not be the money or the material things. It will matter not whatsoever that you were what you were worth. Money won't matter at all, and not much, no matter how much. What will matter most is how you brought meaningful blessings of wisdom into all the lives you touch. The truest measure of a life is what causes those who survive you to keep your spirit forever in their hearts. Will you have bestowed upon them the love and caring they so richly deserved? Will you be remembered as someone who always acted with honor and kept your solemn word? Will they remember the wise advice and counsel they often heard? Will they smile and laugh from time to time when funny things you often said or did might cross their wandering mind? Will they live their lives by following closely in your carefully chosen steps? Will they pass on to their children the virtues you instilled in them, that standing up for righteousness and standing firmly against wrong are as great a moral duty as the promises you've kept? If when you leave all these things are true, then you will be remembered fondly as one who, despite life's adversities, could always be seen standing proud and tall, even when your back was up against the wall. If these traits are what define you in the end, it will be as though you never left at all. And that's from the heart, and it's about doing the right thing and leaving the legacy of moral righteousness behind when you die. Do the right thing, and you know nobody lives forever, but be remembered as somebody who had the courage to stand up and say and do the right thing, you know, when the time counted. And I say that to every veteran, and I say that to our government officials and everybody who considers himself a leader. And I try to teach my children that by leadership through example. It's very important that we do and not join the herd of political correctness.
Can you give us a summary, David, of your thoughts and ideas, your hopes and dreams here in the last couple of minutes before the music comes up, and we'll lead out with that.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you that the CDMRP, in the 5 years I've served with them, it's been a huge honor. It's a lot of hard work and very, very intense intellectually trying to find out what these medical terms and everything. But I can assure veterans listening that there is hope that within the next 3 to 5 years, that may sound like a long time, but we are closer than we've ever been to having effective treatments for these debilitating illnesses so that we can get off of these life-altering opioids and other mind-altering drugs that are routinely prescribed. So keep your chin up and get through each day, and just know that there is a lot of veterans out there, a lot of us out there advocating, pushing for different types of research, and just speaking as loud as we can on Capitol Hill, thanks to folks like Denise Nichols, who's in Washington as we speak. She almost lives there. Those are my thoughts, is that keep your chin up, do what you can to help with the cause, and always say and do the right thing, and don't give up hope. Don't give up hope, because when we do that, we give in to immorality, and we give in to the forces that will destroy one day this country. This country is built upon, you know, citizens who stand up and do the right thing at the right time.
How do you get to your website, David, so any veterans that's not on it can join this conversation and help the other vets?
It's on Facebook, and you just go on Facebook and type in Gulf War Illnesses, and you'll see it's a closed group. You have to request membership, and I am the only one who – I look at everybody who wants to join and make sure they're not some sort of salesman or something, and I let them in if they appear to be legitimate people, as you know nowadays. But that's it's called Gulf War Illnesses, and it's on Facebook.
Well, thank you, David. David, U.S. Marine Corps, retired captain, poet, warrior, veterans advocate. God bless you, and thank you for everything you do, David. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and God bless America.